In the Curly Pajama Letters, Michael writes of Vasco Pajama, who I think is really every man who travels afar with his faithful duck. Michael writes of him, but his searching and restless nature has compelled him into his great voyage of discovery, the circumnavigation of his own world. In the company of his direction-finding duck, a sort of living compass which, according to Vasco, always points towards new joys. I thought Michael, speaking of Vasco, was really speaking of himself. And yet for me, I realize he is also the duck, who is the moral compass that helps us to find true north, our own true direction, which leads us all to true joy. And with that, I would like you to heartily welcome Michael Lunig to speak to us.
Thank you, Burke. I'll do the perfunctory microphone adjustment as part of the ritual. Yeah. It feels... Thank you, Grant. Like so. There we are. So thank you for being here, and I'm very glad to be here. I'm understanding as I go that a lot of you look forward to this time, not just to talk, but just to see each other, and obviously a lot of friendships have been made in this setting, and it's good to be amongst that. It reminds me that I don't have enough of that in my life, and that's the nature of my work. I've sort of sailed across the sea just to read you a little story, very small, and I hope we can perhaps talk about what comes of that. I presume that's possible in this room. We can find what comes up, but it's addressing the idea of the unknown as it's affected me, and I very much I call myself an artist. I've eventually been able to call myself an artist just as a matter of fact, and I've come to understand that what an artist essentially does is to... This is a bit simplistic, but the artist expresses what is repressed. And it's a very simple little tool for me, which makes me more reassured about what I have always done spontaneously. And so this idea of expressing what is repressed necessarily involves the unknown and going there. And I want to read you a little thing I have just written for this occasion. And it's a little, perhaps an allegory based on my own experience of creating. So it's something about the creative process. And I hope it has value for you in your work or it's just a matter to discuss, because I think there are many things, many issues in it. But before I do that, I'll read a tiny little poem I wrote some years ago. It's called The Plot. He's lost the plot, they say, but it simply isn't true. You cannot lose the plot. It's stuck to you. Nor can it be chucked out or thrown into a pit. You can't just dump the plot. You're stuck to it. But you can soak the plot and loosen it with tears and slowly peel it back. It could take years. And you can lose your face, and you can lose a lot and feel blessed when they say, he's lost the plot. So I normally work in the unknown, But I'm not working in the unknown now. I've written something down to read you. So think of me as telling you a little bedtime story from a book. Knowledge brings power and light, but does not necessarily bring wisdom or happiness. It can be a blessing, but can also be hoarded and used to cause harm. Much of what we know and believe is hearsay and mass-minded falsehood. Even accurate information can be like barnacles or cholesterol. It can harden, build up, and block the flow. It can cramp our lives and become a cause of ignorance and illness. The search for knowledge has a great and noble history and a dark, destructive one. Knowledge requires care. Surely we need times of relief from what we know. We need the pleasure and freedom of negative capability, the capacity to live well with uncertainty, and the willingness to say gladly, "I don't know." We might also wonder, does the soul need to know a single thing? Does love know, or is there another form of aliveness available to the inner self? In my life's work as an artist, the creations that I have loved most, the pieces of work that have ultimately brought me the greatest happiness and value, were those usually produced in a strange, uncomfortable state that could be called the unknown. Experience has taught me that not knowing does wonders for the creative juices. This, of course, implies that I have discovered a reliable means of producing art, and that all I have to do is to slip into the unknown and work away at it until a new creation is in the bag. Alas, it is never so easy or pleasant. The truth is that this fertile state is usually a horrible and painful place to be in. So nasty is it that after visiting there you never want to return, but return you do, again and again, many, many times. You can't really get there by intention. You end up there usually through failure and calamity. I will now relate how an artist frequently gets into the unknown, and the point of this story could equally apply to making a human relationship work as much as to creating an artwork. The artist in this simplified story is a painter. He gets an idea for a painting. The muse has paid a visit. The light has come on, inspiration has struck, whatever. And now the idea must be given form. The urge is powerful, the feeling exuberant, and the approach is confident. So the artist gets organized and with high hopes sets about transcribing the vision from his mind onto the canvas. Excuse me. After working for a while, he starts to sense that things are sagging somewhat and the painting looks very boring. It has no spirit. It looks competent enough, but lacks the spark and mystique that was in his mind at the beginning. Something has been lost in the translation. How odd. It's not transcribing. So he redoubles his efforts and sets about rescuing the situation. But to his dismay, it only seems to get worse. He becomes frustrated and anxious and works harder to redeem things, but it just gets drearier, and the more he tries, the more the life drains out of it. After all his hours of earnest work, it looks ludicrous, pretentious and soulless. What lies before him now is a full-blown expression of his delusional art pomposity. He feels disillusioned, failed, and foolish. At this point, he could scrape the canvas clean and walk away, or else title the painting "The Wreckage of My Ego" and hang it on his studio wall as a humbling reminder. Painting teaches much about failure. Instead, as if inspired by divine perversity, He decides to stay with disaster and to deepen his disturbance. He hangs his head and utters many forlorn words such as, "Oh, shit." Or, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" He has spoken the magic words of surrender. They are the secret passwords announcing that he is now on his painful journey downwards into the darkness. He feels appalling. Where lesser artists would call it a day and depart from the squalor, he feels compelled to stay, as if to stubbornly defend himself from failure. Yet what is happening is liberation, a stripping away of theory, aspiration and identity, a humiliation that is strangely enlivening. The ego has come a cropper. He is lost and far from home. Everything he knows is of little use. Instead of an ascent into art heaven as hoped for, there has been a painful descent into wretchedness. The artist has regressed and ended up in the mud with feelings of despair, shame, anxiety, regret, and self-disgust. He is now beginning to resemble a genius. What the muse has given him is not an artwork as he had thought, but the hidden doorway into the desolate unknown, plus enough eros and daring to enter. In the privacy of his studio, at this point, anger and the need to transgress or lash out may arise. Sudden, revengeful and destructive impulses could result in the half-finished painting being vandalised. Perhaps a few slashes with a brushload of paint, or a light-hearted and irreverent doodle in the wet surface of the image with the fingernail. What is there to lose? The painting is already a lost cause. Why not play and experiment in the ruins before tossing it aside? It could be fun. Perhaps a private, infantile pleasure might compensate for all the disappointment. The essential quality of playing freely is enjoyment. We play to please ourselves. It awakens the sleeping part of the imagination and allows the exhausted part to have a much-needed sleep. A situation conducive to invention, insight and originality. The true self is free to romp about in pleasure, to dabble like a duck, to take chances and make discoveries or mistakes without consequence. In such joyous abandonment, inhibitions melt. A special sensitivity is primed. Windows fly open and a fresh vision becomes possible. Art and love may now intertwine and flourish. So in this little breakdown, the artist plays and muddles about without constraint, doing reckless things he wouldn't normally consider. He starts to enjoy what his delinquent hand is doing, and marvels at the improbable shapes and marks that are appearing in the ruins of his failed and timid work. The way the pink has smeared into the vermilion and the way the pale blue shines through the scratches. To his amazement, he starts to find mysteries and tantalising elements in the disorder. He starts to recognise old visual pleasures and fresh new ones. He sees that his hand has a mind of its own and has painted a bemused face into the otherwise dreary branches of the tree. And the lacklustre hills he had attempted are now a sleeping orange woman who smiles in peaceful rapture. He loves what is being painted. Love and recognition are working together, and he's enchanted by the beautiful mess of it all. The painting's development is taking him by surprise, as if some brilliant other is creating. Energy is returning to the studio. The Zen idea of wabi-sabi is now happily in play. The value of the unfinished, the impermanent and the imperfect. The words of Picasso have come to life. "I do not search, I find." The artist is creating his way out of trouble. He is making things he has never made before. At the end of the day, he is exhausted, but in good spirits, and he sleeps well. In the morning, he rushes out to see what he has created, and lo and behold, an epiphany of delight from the previous day's struggle greets him and embraces his imagination. He has forgotten the terrors of descending into the unknown, but at least he knows that in order to create something truly joyous, he'll need faith, love, and poetic strength enough to lose the plot and do it all over again. That is my little story. It has arisen from experience. And I somehow feel, not just of painting and of writing a few lines, and I'm reminded when I hear that beautiful song, for which I give my warmest thanks, you know, when a little tear comes to your eye, when you hear your work become so harmonious and melodic, who would imagine that its origin was that desperate, distraught little struggle? And then to write it down, and then that it goes into the world and someone picks it up, and then it becomes this thing. So every time we hear music, or we see a painting, or we read a poem or a novel, perhaps we don't need to think of some struggle, but I'm sure in this setting we might imagine that. So I'm a great believer in these things like failure and self-disgust, and these things that therapists work so hard to deal with in people. And yes, I have to work on them too. But they can be momentary passing things of great value, that sort of sense of failure. I can imagine that in some parts of the psychotherapy world, things like self-loathing are kind of obscenities, perhaps. But I can see the value that we can have these moments. They seem to be natural. They seem to arise. And they can be survived, and they can be of value, and they can be used. And that guilt itself is a worthy feeling, as long as we don't use it to bring up children, but to feel it. And but that we can feel some responsibility and some... So I rather value guilt, but it moves on and it becomes another thing. So many of these feelings which we try to... move away from so quickly, I think we must hold them for a while and have them, and they are energizing things, and as long as we can put them down and move on to the next terrible feeling. But of course, it goes without saying that one believes in all of the joyous feelings and those life-giving exuberant feelings and love, etc. But you can't, as we know, have one without the other. And I read a little poem. I'll read another little poem at this point, which touches on this theme. And so much of my work, I realise as I stand here now in the midst of psychotherapy, which interests me greatly. I mean, New Zealand interests me and psychotherapy interests me. I don't know what the link is. But Burke was trying to get me to come here, and I thought, oh, yes, I'm kind of fascinated by psychotherapy and also by New Zealand. And I won't go into the details of that, but... if you grow up in Australia, you think of New Zealand as sort of... similar cousin, you know. I was brought up to think that. This is like our cousins are over there. I know that brings terrible feelings to New Zealanders, but ugly feelings. This is a little poem I read at a public talk last night. Just some words. A life. Anyone can get a life. Anyone can lose it. But who will dare to inhabit the thing and use it? A lived-in life will soon get loose and worn from use and feeling. Countless tiny scratches, the shine goes off. It's very unappealing. Dirt builds up, a load of muck and grit. A part of you gets lost. A hope, a philosophy, or a love that doesn't fit. Another broken sleep. A dream collapses. A quick repair. It's worth a try. A scrap of string from the soul. Perhaps a battered grin will fill the hole, or just a sigh. Flakes and cracks. A major idea buckles badly. A makeshift support is put up quickly. A tired old joke could hide the dent, or be a wedge, or a patch, or a splint, truly, sweetly, sadly. And yet it works and lives. It all still goes. It forgives. It's a miracle. Worn in, bashed in, cried in. And the great thing, a lived-in life can be happily died in. So, I hear talk here of the land and the connection to nature and some growing awareness and interest in reconnecting. And I spoke in my little story of regression, and I think of how our culture, our ways have always talked of progression or going upwards and the notions of excellence and that which is up there in the clouds. And I have learned to value through my experience as an artist the idea of regression and that we must go downwards. And downwards is not pretty and it's not attractive. And I also think of how much we have been told we must be attractive and how much of the culture is about being attractive in all its ways, in all its many ways, to be brilliant with words, to be physically attractive, to be whatever, to be great in some way, to have awards hanging on the wall. And I think you really have to develop a love of unattractiveness to be free and kind of, and therefore the idea of regressing and having these murky feelings and messed up feelings and not knowing and not looking good and being disordered, and to hold those things I found very valuable. And the reason it's valuable is that it sort of works. It works in that it is fertile, and it. And I'm only giving you the artist experience. It is uncanny because it strips away so much, and there within is this other sort of thing that gets going if only we dare have it and submit to it and know that it doesn't last forever. And so I'm only saying it not as an ideal or a kind of a theory. I'm just describing practical experience. And I can't imagine, and I found it to be true of so many areas of life, particularly human relationships. It gets nasty. But going to nature requires some regression. I think we've outgrown it and grown up away from it, and it requires some going down, and not in such a goodly way necessarily. And such a it's now the green movement quite rightly is surrounded by a lot of fine ideals, but there's another kind of going to nature. And it means going to human nature. And I think the two things are just so intertwined. And I think to go into those murky feelings is like going into the forest. It really is. And I think it is our human nature that has been so degraded, as the broader nature has been degraded and undervalued. I think our human nature has been so undervalued. And just as we poured, humanity poured its DDT and its chemicals into the rivers in innocence, not understanding the consequences, I think we are at a stage with human nature where we are still doing that. We still pour terrible toxins and degrading elements into ourselves in innocence. And I think of Rachel Carson, who wrote that important book in the 60s or the 50s, 1950s or 60s, The Silent Spring, who brought attention to this thing. And it was quite a revelation to the world that we didn't know what we were doing. And I think our attitude to human nature, we're not sure what we're doing. We're starting to wake up. And I think this disparity between nature and humanity is very interesting. And the similarity, I think the extent to which the natural world is degraded is probably about the same as what human nature is also degraded. I think we are probably a very damaged environment in some respects. But go into nature and it's still beautiful, and go into the human heart and it's still beautiful. So the seeds are there. So it's not a dismal story. But it's this unknown business and going downwards that I think is very important. And the ability and the courage and the faith to do it. And a point I was making the other morning in a session, to enjoy it, to actually enjoy being there, not doing it because it's virtuous, but doing it because it's enjoyable. Not doing it because it's the right thing to do, but doing it because it's enjoyable. I don't think we'll ever do it well unless we enjoy doing it. I don't think an artist will ever paint a lovely picture unless they're enjoying it and being in love with it. And I imagine for you in your work, you must love it somewhere. You must love. And I made a point the other morning, which might be contentious, that somewhere in all the suffering that you must encounter, you must see suffering as somehow beautiful in the way that death is beautiful. There is a terror in death, but ultimately it is beautiful. And that's not just theory, I believe. And I think that human suffering has a huge beauty to it, but that depends on our understanding of the word beauty. Beauty is not necessarily attractive. So having read my little tale and said these random sort of off-the-cuff words, is there anything anybody would like to say to me, or perhaps lead me out somewhere else, or ask me about something that I haven't made clear? I often talk in poetic ways rather than literal ways, and I'm not sure in your world whether, and in your training, whether poetic exchange is common. But it's very ambiguous, it's evocative, it leaves something for the other to work with. I'm not telling you anything. People sometimes say, what does that cartoon mean? I say, well, I don't really know. I like it. And it's what it means to you. Oh, what are you trying to put into people? I'm not putting anything into people. I'm trying, hopefully, to be part of the awakening of what's in them. And I think that's what art does. I envy the musicians so much because They do this all the time. They make abstractions. They make sound. And no one has any problem understanding it. They don't ask, what does that tune mean? They hear it. Tears appear. But, you know, a poem, a painting, is the same thing, really. You just let it flow into you and see what happens. So I'm often trying to justify what I'm doing, but I don't really like to. Burke.
In your two books, Prayer Tree and A Book of Common Prayer,
yes,
you have that picture of the little everyman, and in Common Prayer, he's kneeling in front of a duck.
Yes.
And in Prayer Tree, I think there's the tree, and there's the man, and there's the duck. Now, would you speak to us? You're talking about alignment with nature. You're talking about alignment with spirit. Mm. Would you say something about the relationship of that man with that duck?
Well, when I wrote those words, Burke, I was really recovering my real feelings towards ducks when I was a child. And what is this thing a child can do, and to look at something like a duck and be with it and sit there staring at it and feel this sort of, affinity, and not understand what it is. It's a going down. That's a lovely enjoying, this sort of going down away from knowledge and stuff. It's just a natural creature. So I did that. And then I learned in later life, and I started putting them into my drawings, because the world I lived in, the political journalistic world, was so kind of brainy, you know, brain ridden, and the political cartoons were so sort of conflicting and aggressive and mocking and making caricatures which hurt people. It was sort of based on that, and witticisms. You know, sometimes I curse Oscar Wilde for setting up this style of the cutting remark, you know, because so many intellectuals try and copy him, and I think, oh, it's a terrible thing. Anyway, so that's where I was. And one day I put a duck in a cartoon because I was in revulsion at all this braininess and knowledge and cut and thrust of politics. I said, the world needs more ducks. So I put one in a cartoon. And so much of what an artist is doing is just doing it, putting something into a picture or a poem, not because it's laden with meaning, but because they like it. They like it. They enjoy it. They feel that joy comes from it. And they put it there. And later, of course, there are meanings. And you, intuitively, you know their meanings, I guess. So that's how it works. And so a duck goes into the political world. This innocent creature with a rounded beak that can't pick anything, really, can't really hurt anyone. They can accidentally scratch you when you pick them up. And they, as I say, they dabble away. They're who doesn't like ducks? What beast doesn't like a duck? Similar with a teapot. A teapot is not a contentious object. People don't argue over teapots. And yet they are there. We grow up with them. There they sit on our grandmother's table. We see adults pick it up and pour this warm liquid and they enjoy it. And it was always thus and always will be. So there are not many eternal, you know, artifacts like that in our lives, and so they're worth just sort of putting in a cartoon or something. It doesn't sit well in the intellectual world sometimes to have an unexplained teapot or a duck. But these little symbols, these little images do resonate. They go in under the radar. And that's not a cynical reason you do it, but they just do. And so many things, as you would know in your work, that one word spoken, that small phrase goes in under the radar. Not intentionally or cynically, it comes out of nowhere, but it goes into something. And it's like that. So the duck, I don't know whether I've explained the duck, Burke, but there is much to be further talked about the duck. I mean, I could tell you lots more about the duck. I could tell you the story that I told last night, but... Well, it's a long story, but I can do this sort of very quick version if I be careful. Eventually, after putting all these ducks in, and this idea of the direction-finding duck is if you just follow the duck, it will, you know, go with the duck. It will always manage to know a good place to be and a happy thing, and joy seems to come. And, of course, this is fanciful fairy tale stuff, naturally. We can't live... You know, when the pilot is flying me over in the aeroplane, I'm glad he's not watching ducks. I'm glad he's watching the instrument panel. But we understand that. So the duck is a poetic thing. It's a concept. What is the duck as a part of ourselves? This lovely, playful thing that floats about innocently. And I love playing. So the duck... So I do all these ducks and people say, what's the meaning of the duck? And I say, I don't know, I just like the duck. Isn't that enough? And then one day, in the mail comes a letter. And it's an essay. It's an essay written by a contemporary of Carl Jung, Marie-Louise von France. And she was a contemporary of Jung. And she wrote a short essay... The archetypal significance of the duck in German mythology. And it appears, it was a very interesting little essay, it appears the duck is a kind of a symbol of transcendence, or the duck arrives when you are stuck, somehow stuck, you are, and you can't move forward, and the duck arrives and leads you to the next thing. As is found in the story of Hansel and Gretel. Hansel and Gretel have been captured by the Wicked Witch. They escape. They try and get back home. They come to a river or a lake. The duck appears and carries them over. Apparently this pops up. The duck is there in German mythology in this manner. So then I think, oh, well, now I know. Now I've got an answer. You know, but what fascinated me was the fact that I was intuitively somehow had found this in this liking of the duck. This simple, primal, infantile liking of the duck and the daring to put it into the adult world and to the intellectual world. And so I say, oh, good. But now, next chapter. I have this name Lunig, which I didn't know where it came from. We thought it was German. My father had vague notions of a great-grandfather who came from Germany, but never knew for sure what it was. So one day I had some friends who are painters, and they were painting a large mural, a very large mural on a canvas. It was for the National Gallery of Australia, for their big restaurant to go up on the wall, a group mural. I visited a studio where it was being done. They invited me to put a duck in there. They said, come on, put a duck in there. So I quickly painted a little duck in there. It was sent off, it went up on the wall. Underneath was a bronze plaque who had painted the mural. My name was included, which was a bit of a fiasco. I had only put a duck in, but there's my name. Months passed. An old gentleman from New York was visiting Australia. He went to the gallery. He had a coffee. He looked up. He saw the painting. He saw the name Lunig. It was his name also. He said, who is that? He was told. He contacted me. He sent me a family tree. The family tree goes back to the 16th century. All the details, the grisly details, to a little mining town in the Harz Mountains of Germany. In due course, I travel to the little village. I find the mine. I find the birth records in the church. I find the mine. Now, something open to the public, I'd go down the mine. It is the blackest, blackest hole in the world. And I stand in the darkness under the ground in Germany, and I think of my ancestors, and I think of the little duck I put in the painting, which allowed me to get to that point and understand my name. And having dealt with it, I'm not curious anymore. It's not a very interesting story, my background. I don't celebrate it too much, but it was dealt with. So these are the little magic things about working spontaneously to me. I don't know that the science in that, but, you know, this need to put a duck in. Who knows where it leads? And I imagine in your work to put a duck in, or the equivalent, who knows where it leads? You know that. You know that. Is there any other loose end, some that we want loosened further? There is, yes. Well, the degradation of human nature sounds terribly sort of extreme, I guess, but it's a sort of the degradation of neglect, and that our culture has been so aspirational and forward-thrusting and moving forward and materialistic, we know these things, and something's lost in doing that. I think it's pretty plain what I'm saying, that, and the idea of recovering human nature is embarrassing to many people, is to have it, to get back to it. We will think it's all, if we get back to nature, we're going to go upwards, or we've got to sort of become better in some way. I think, yes, while that seems true, there's some other movement that we are capable of which requires, as I say, regression is a word which probably means something in your world, and maybe it's similar in the way I mean it, but to dare to go downwards and the sky won't fall in, you know, all hell will not break loose. So recovering the senses, and this lovely term, coming to our senses, you've got to come to your senses. Come to your senses, man. You know, it means sharpen up. But it also means go to your senses. So there's an eros and sensuality I think we're very deprived of, and an inhibition, and that's what I mean. And so something falls into neglect. Human nature is a wilderness. It's a wilderness. It's not a pretty park. But we know how beautiful the wilderness it is, and we know how dangerous it is. So that's... Does that...
Yeah, thank
you. Love it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, these are just my feelings after all these years on Earth. I have no study to confirm any of that. Whatsoever. Was there another little hand that wandered up? Yes. Just a little bit louder, if you could. Yeah, a person comes into therapy. Oh, good.
It's in the notion of play, and what immediately comes to my mind is Sweet Violets,
yes.
Which I haven't heard. Sweet Violets.
Sweet. Yeah.
It's a song of a long time ago.
Oh yes, I know the song.
And. The woman then immediately goes into, my grandmother used to grow violets, and we have a whole kind of session about her and her grandmother. Mm. Now, in time-constricted therapy, I think that wouldn't be seen as at all useful.
That wouldn't be seen as useful?
As useful at all, because there would be goals and all that sort of stuff, criteria to meet. Mm.
So you're saying someone comes in, sings Sweet Violets, or you sing Sweet Violets, and they say, oh, my grandmother sang that song. So that's of no value,
that's
you would
right.
think. Generally, I mean, I'm sure not everyone would agree with that, would they? Well, but I mean, yes, I can imagine how that might be so.
Yes.
But that would be a disaster, wouldn't it,
yes,
if it wasn't
it would
important?
Be. Exactly.
And because of this principle, I find, as my work has revealed to me, that unless you are enjoying, and that doesn't just mean being happy, enjoying is being knocked down and getting up, and you know, it's all the whole thing, it's engagement. I think enjoyment is engagement too. And unless you're doing it, how could you be doing it? Well, I just think that the state of enjoyment brings out on a very intensified kind of insight and intelligence and creativity. I think if you're labouring too earnestly and clenched, and it seems that so much activity in Western society comes with a very clenched position and a forceful, thrusting position, which achieves certain things, but denies the possibility of other things. And I would have thought in your work that one must open and open and open, and that doesn't mean letting go of sensitivity, but there's a type of freshening of sensitivity and alertness that would happen, I imagine. And then this recognition comes, and I think recognition is the key in making anything. You recognize that something is true or significant. Mm. There's one down the back first, and I'll come there. Yes. I can't. Yeah, if we might wait. Thank you.
I've spent years of my life wondering, saying to myself, why on earth have I got tears in my eyes? And you've explained it to me in a way by saying you're in a point of harmony. Because I know that when I go to a gallery and I look at a picture, I get tears in my eyes and I know, oh, that must be the one for me. Or I meet somebody and I get tears in my eyes, or I have a moment in therapy with a patient, I get tears in my eyes and I think, why have I got tears in my eyes? But and then when I went to the Marae yesterday and I was allowed to sit on the Maori side because I'd been there in the morning, I burst into tears and I thought, why am I doing this? And now I think you've explained it. It's something about harmony. Here I am at 60 and this is finally filtered into my skull. So I don't know if you want to say any more about that or...
Yeah, well, of course, there's a great mocking of tears in the contemporary world, you know, or the lefty lovies or the et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, tears must always be true. I mean, I know I've heard of crocodile tears, but even in crocodile tears there are... I don't believe they're entirely false. There's some level of truth. I always regard tears as a great sign that something's moving and some little thing has been put to rest or is healing or something like that. There's something shifting. I mean, fascinating what are tears. And I think that recognition at a primal level of something is it brings tears. People frequently cry with music. And that's just one of the great things. So I don't know, they're mysteries, but I think they're good, or they're always sort of beneficial. Part of this human ecosystem, this ecosystem we carry around in us, this fragile ecosystem. I mean, we are so strong. We are so sort of omnipotent and powerful, and we can do things and achieve things, and the mind can mobilize all kinds of strengths and powers. But I think we forget. This omnipotence is almost infantile, the sense that we are not fragile. We're immensely fragile. And it's an ecosystem just like that fragile one out there. And once we get this sense of that we are fragile, it doesn't mean to say we're not strong, but it's a balances and things matter and that things are kept in balance. And I think tears are part of that ecosystem somewhere, some little river, you know. Oh, yes, there was one here first and I'll come along. Yes?
Thank you. Michael, you were speaking about suffering and finding the beauty in suffering, finding it beautiful, and I can resonate with that. And yet I'm wondering if you might loosen up a little bit, because with my questioning around this is that some people's suffering, if I were to see it as beautiful, I would find that quite difficult.
Yes. Well, as I said, it depends on one's understanding of beauty. Is beauty something we just sit and observe and enjoy? I don't think it is. I mean, it can be that, but there's something sacred I'm talking about. And I'm talking about something truthful, you know. Beauty is truth and truth is beauty. That is all there is to know. So I'm trying to, as I said, I'm talking poetically when I say that. We've grown to think of beauty as something that's up there, as something desirable and attractive, or somehow enjoyable and is used to fill ourselves up with and gratify ourselves with sometimes. And I'm not talking of that. I'm just talking about the sacredness of suffering. And it's horrible too. Of course it is. That's evident and that's at the first point of entry into suffering. But I'm talking about if you don't also hold that there is something profoundly sacred there. And as I was saying, people in their suffering have an enormous truth going on in them, which is sometimes expressed like never before. And I do not see how you can't be moved by that. And it can bring you to tears. And those tears is a link to what is sacred and what is beautiful. And it's a reverence for suffering. And it doesn't mean to say we're disengaged from the suffering, but you can have reverence and be very engaged and attend to suffering if that's what it calls for. So I don't know whether that clarifies it, but it's this implication, oh, suffering is beautiful. Give me suffering. I need beauty, you know. It's not like that. But unless so many of us turn away from suffering, don't we? That's the human. I've ever watched a dog get run over by a car and the other dogs go and attack it as it lies there whimpering. This is a funny, terrible primal impulse in some animals. There's a disdain of weakness and suffering and vulnerability. And vulnerability is very threatening. If you display your vulnerability, you are a very menacing presence sometimes to some. So I'm just trying to, how do you turn that around? I just find that when people are suffering and in the presence of a dying person is a great privilege to be, not a gratifying one, but it's sacred. As Rilke said in that beautiful poem, for the sake of a single poem, I don't have it here, but in order to write 10 good lines at the end of your life, you must have done the following. And he lists all the things, you know, and one of them is to have sat in a room with a dying person. So, and we're all dying all the time, aren't we? But you see, and so that's suffering.
Michael, in our work, we enter the life of the suffering and those who are in great distress and pain and learn to companion them. in that place of losing the plot. I'm always quite taken with the artists and poets of the world who manage to know a lot about suffering and their own despair and haven't done years of therapy.
And haven't
necessarily done years of therapy.
Yeah.
And I wonder who your companions have been and what companions you in these places.
It seems I've taken them for granted. I can't name them if it's like that, but just many, 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 so varied, many, every moment, and some there's a voice, there's a presence, there's something. Who companions me? Maybe I'm uncompanioned too much. I think there is loneliness. Sorry? The duck. Well, the metaphor that the duck is. I don't know. I feel okay on this earth. I feel it's there are a lot of people. They're all my fellow creatures. They're my people. I feel an affinity. I love to be with them. I love to not be with them. I companion myself. I don't know. I don't know. What has gone before? The poets? You read a bit of Rumi or something like that, or I am. Well, this isn't Rumi, this is John Clare, I am. But who I am, none knows or cares. What is the rest of it? I don't know. But with these poets who just talk about existential loneliness and the beauty of loneliness, that suffering, there is beauty in it. And I think we've put beauty too much in the light and enjoyment too much in the light. And if we move it into the dark a bit, there is great pleasure in the dark also. It sounds arrogant to saying that pain is pleasure, and that sounds perverse. But maybe we also have a great fear of pain and we spend our lives avoiding death and pain. It seems madness. I just think we should be welcoming death all from the time we're born, in a sense, you know, and saying, well, it's going to happen. We're going to grow old and fall apart and all that. I mean, why pretend anything else? Why not get used to the idea? And how bad can it be? I mean, it ends. It ends. Maybe I had too much suffering when I was a child and I got used to it. I thought, oh, well, it won't be so bad when I die. It'll be good. I'll be out of here. I don't know. But we die. And there are black jokes about death, and I'm glad there are dark jokes about death. There are.
We often sit down and meet people when they're in a very terrified or dark place. How do you encourage a duck to show up in that kind of terror?
You could bring one into the room. I don't know. I imagine psychotherapy is very slow, isn't it? Very slow. And it has to be patient. And the duck does turn up, you see. That's what I'm saying. I don't think you bring it in. It appears. And hopefully. And, of course, you can't always succeed. You know, you will fail also. But I think getting to the point of failure is what I'm talking about. Almost welcome the disaster. Because if you keep... I can't tell you how you do your work, but it seems to me that there must come a point in the sequence of therapy where there is failure, there's disarray, there's you've lost the plot, they've lost the plot. How do you stay with it is the question. And I think one has to have an actual erotic enjoyment. And I don't mean sexual. I mean eros, the life force. There's life in staying with it, you know. There's life. And you've got to have a love of chaos or an ability to bear it and see that it's fertile. And you can get the hell out of all the things you've learned. You know, all this theory I learned and all this supervision and whatever, I just... go away. Maybe then you are clear to be you, and when everything you know is lost temporarily, because you're going to need it again, obviously. Oh, look, I'm being very presumptuous here, but so I think how you get the duck is, well, go with the despair and the pain, and if you can, if the person can, don't try and quell it too quickly. Let it bleed. My father was a slaughterman. My father was a slaughterman. And he came home frequently with terrible cuts on his hands. And he used to tell me, it's best if you let it bleed. And the poor man. And I feel there's some wisdom in that, if that's a poetic metaphor also. So, could be a disaster. Who knows? All the people you see and what the situations are, I don't know. But I imagine there are times when you've got to let it bleed and be there and let it bleed on you and say it's okay to bleed. I imagine. That's what I do. I tried to talk about this the other day. We all learn. I grew up in a time when young men are always can be violent, and I grew up surrounded by a fair bit of industrial, working class, male youth violence, and there was always these situations of distressed males wanting to fight someone or hurt someone, and you would have to somehow come step into this and try and say, yes, I understand. And you kind of have to cuddle it a bit, you know, and boys learn how to do this to men out of control sometimes. And you find there's a miraculous softening in even a violent man in that anguish.
Thanks, Michael, for your wise words. When you were describing your experience as an artist, it felt very much a description of working as a therapist.
Yes.
So I felt very akin to that. What going into the states that are full of whatever negative or hard emotion seems totally essential. So I think a lot of our work is softening the defences or the mind or the body tension so that these states can be reached. And I guess the difference is we do it in partnership as a pairing, as a coupling with our clients, whereas you do it more on your own with your creativity and your expression. And sometimes I think it's a really, really wacky job I do, because you're sitting with such painful states, and sometimes for quite long periods of time. So I think the creativity of the therapist between those states and what we do is actually very important, because sometimes our clients can take quite a while to move through these states. So I'm very interested in time as the fourth dimension. My experience is when any of us go deeply into the state, fully inhabit it, it pops into something transformative. Something transformative.
Yeah.
And I heard you describing something very similar to that. So I'm very interested in, I suppose, what stops the full inhabitation of the loathing, the hatred, the terror. So I guess in my work I'm informed by softening the defences into feeling it fully. I'm kind of interested in, I think you're saying you fully inhabit those states. Is that what you're saying?
I inhabit them, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, to the degree that I can, I kind of know can now recognise when I'm feeling lousy about what I set out to do. But this idea of intention, I have this intention, I have this idea, I'm going to make the painting, or you have this idea, you're going to help the person. And often there is, yes, there's this descent. It goes wrong, or the unexpected. There's something missing. That the idea, the intention to help is also an egotistical thing.
Yeah.
And it must be so. It is the doorway. But you must go through that, is what I'm saying, and expect that going through it will perhaps be dark. Now, I recognise that there are many who would completely denounce this idea. There are many artists who would say, what's this guy talking about? I am a disciplined draftsman. I draw according to the great classical theories. I know what I'm doing. I will do it methodically and slowly, and I will create a painting. And yes, this happens. So be it. But I'm talking about another type of creation, which starts with one intention, encounters a collapse, a regression, and a discovery. And how does one keep alive to those things and not try and brush any of them aside, but know that they are, it's fertility. There's some fertility in this. And it's unknown. You don't know where it's leading. There's no method. There's a kind of, it's all informed by method, but in the midst of that chaos, you know that it could be the best place to be. And you find something you never saw before. I'm sure every painting or therapy session or the great things is when you've been lost and you find a new thing, a thing you think, did we make this together? How extraordinary. We made this together. And I can say that of my relationship with the material and the thing, and you're talking about a relationship, of course. So it's a beautiful surprise of not until you get lost can you find, and not until you're down can you see. You know, so much of the truths are lie down at our feet and not up there, and I think you have to go down and find what's at your feet. And it's that idea that the hand has a mind of its own. It moves in truthful ways. And if it's guided too much by the brain, it kind of is stilted, and the world is full of that, and it's good and worthy and it does wonderful things. But I'm talking about this other possibility where the hand can be allowed to move. And I don't know what the equivalent is in psychotherapy, possibly the heart. If the heart can be allowed to have its way, and there's transgression, and I'm not talking about abusive transgression, but you know, a departure from propriety in some senses may even be required. I don't know. I mean, that's a pretty risque thing to say, but in your world, but I can transgress as much as I like in the privacy of my studio. But and yes, and there's a delinquency for me is necessary. No, not always. But sometimes you can find yourself think, oh, why did I do such a childish thing? Why did I pick up the red and go, eh, onto the thing? You know, after working very hard and in a mature way, and I can finally be really, oh, I'm looking, I think, why bother? I've done all this years ago. There's no joy in this. And then there's, so you punish the painting a bit. Just momentarily. And that's the hand, you know, that picks up the thing and throws the cup at the wall when you're in a domestic argument. Sometimes good comes of that. I wouldn't recommend it, but it happens, and it's not always a disaster. You know, sometimes it's a thing that humbles someone when they realise they've broken a window and now they've got to get it fixed. Or something like that, I don't know, whatever. But I don't know what the equivalent in therapy is. But maybe suddenly a revelation by the therapist when they're not a person who reveals. I heard someone talking about that. They sort of went a bit further than they normally would in self-revelation. But that's a kind of a maybe. Could be great, but it mightn't be what you intend to do. But it might be just what's ideal. And it doesn't mean anything's lost, I wouldn't think. Sorry? Yes. I imagine with therapy that there's a lot of training and a lot of order, and there's a therapy hour and the clock is ticking. It must be not as so easy. In my studio, I can have a glass of wine. I don't do that, but I could if I wanted. You are very structured, and I admire the ability to be structured and allow the unconscious to come up. I mean, if that's what's happening. But it frequently comes up not as a lovely thing, but a mistake. I think it comes when the mistake happens. Yes?
I'm anxious that the metaphor you have used for creating art through regression, collapse and regression, and we have taken up for the way we do psychotherapy, also going down to the unconscious, that it might also be a metaphor for the world and where we're going. And these outward aspirations in the outer world may get to a point of collapse, and that may be the only way we get back. I fear that collapse, and I wonder whether you can comment on what can be done to counter the toxicity that exists in the way the world is moving at the moment.
Yes, I can see what you're saying. You're probably, and perhaps I'm sounding too fatalistic, it's all going to collapse and that will be a good thing because we'll find our way out of trouble. And there's some truth in that. I mean, systems are collapsing already. It's not the big bang at the end. I mean, things are collapsing. Not all, and some things are being born also. But it's the idea that you can have both, that you can have a collapse and still you have two hands. Here this one is collapsing and this one is holding something somewhere. I think it's that duality that's very important. Regression doesn't mean it's got a sort of an abandonment of the essential self. I think it's an ability. It's a skill to allow, and I think a war is a kind of regression, and who wants that? Yes. Sorry? Yes. See, what I'm wondering, is there a kind of a mature innocence that's possible? Can one... I know innocence isn't something you can develop, but I'm wondering if there is a mature innocence. I believe there is, and it's this... Getting back to the question from over here about regression, I think regression is going back to a kind of an unknowing and a primal kind of infantile state almost. Don't we retain? Isn't there a child still there? Isn't there a continuity going right back for those of us fortunate enough to have continuity? And doesn't it come to bear on what we do? And it does for the artist that the child is there, hopefully, always going at it. But working with the mature adult. So that's the glory of it, that the two are there working together, it would seem to me. That if you can, if you can only move forward at the expense of getting rid of the past, that's a terrible fate. But that if the child is still there, and I know that can sound a fashionable thing to say, but I can't avoid to say that it's good to be able to access that. That wonder, to sit with the duck and look at it and say, what is that? I wrote a little piece about the word God once, and I thought, oh, all this talk about God or no God, and there's been an atheist convention in Melbourne recently, and the atheists are sounding like missionaries now. They're all, once atheism used to be a private position, it was rather dignified, and said, oh, no, not for me, thanks. But now it's sort of, they're thumping the lectern and banging on, and I don't get it. They're worse than the, you know, the God people. But, and I'm thinking, the way I came to this idea of God, which I've used in my little prayer books, and it was like this. I'm a child. I can't speak. I'm pre-language. And I'm just looking at things. No words attached. I see the light coming through the window. It's a sensation. It's just beautiful or fascinating or whatever, you know, you're there staring, it's going in, it's impressing, beautiful time and all the miseries of it as well, but and then you start to sort of hear words and understand. I don't know that point, you come into language, and then you hear your grandmother sing a little song, a lullaby. Where are you going, pretty birdie? I am going to the woods. What's in the woods? Anyway, the birds are in the woods, and they sing God's love. So this word, what's God? What's God's love? Okay, put that one in. I don't know what God is. So you hear it in the language. Then you hear your father hit his thumb with a hammer. He says, oh, God, you know, or something like that. Or your mother says, oh, God knows what's going on today, or something like this. And then you hear this character, you know, as a child, you don't know. It's like the light coming through a window. It's just a word. So you hear people using it. So that's God, you see. It's just this word for me. And it's in the vernacular. It's in the sacred text. But I don't know what it is. But I accept it. It's a word. I use it. And how did I get to this? what was the question again? It was...
Michael, one of the titles of your books is A Cartoonist Conversation with God.
That's right. And I like God as a one-word poem. That's how I can handle it. I think unless you handle this word poetically, you're doomed. You're always going to be struggling against it. So for me, it's been a one-word poem. I don't know whether I've answered any question at all. where will I go, Burke? Listen,
I think we're only going to get a couple more questions before we're going to have to wrap Michael.
I see three, so we can get three. There's that one, and that one. Yes, the two-handed person always gets attention.
No, you don't have a microphone. I'll bring it back.
Shall I?
Yeah, you go.
Okay. Yeah, Michael, in your book, The Prayer Tree, there's a lovely poem about friendship and struggling with friends and hanging in with friends. I don't know if you remember it, but it's one I've read a lot to groups I've worked with. I'm interested in what inspired that poem for you. How come you wrote that poem?
I probably was feeling very lonely, I think. No, I don't know, but as I remember it, it was about the friends, they give us this, they give us that, but they give us a hard time.
They let us down.
They let us down. We fail and are failed and all that sort of thing. Yes, it was the broad nature of the full spectrum of friendship, the woes and the... Yeah. I don't know why. I think I was having some sort of problem with journalists at the time. And I've been having problems ever since. I realised too late in life that I was a kind of an artist working in journalism. Not a good match. Not a good thing to do. Yeah. But that was probably it. It's full of wicked politics, as is psychotherapy, so I've heard. I didn't believe it. I only heard it.
Thank you, Michael. It's been wonderful. And I'm feeling like I'm sort of in a cloud, and I'm kind of, you know, the bottom of the cloud is raining and there's sunshine above me, and I'm kind of looking up and down, floating in that. And what has occurred to me as I've been listening to you is that there's an amazing amount of trust. And I'm wondering if you could tell us where that comes from.
Yes, I'm aware of trust, and I suppose it's naivety to some extent. Maybe I've been fortunate that my trust has... I've survived many situations where I've trusted, and I have been hurt, of course, massively, massively, of course. But somehow it seems, once again, I come back, it seems an enjoyable position to be in, to trust. The other thing leads to anxiety, does it not? And maybe there's a middle position, you know, diligent caution, etc. But I don't want to live... I don't want to live like that, and I'm prepared to die. I think I've always felt that I could die at any moment. You know, I could be struck down, or it's a violent world or something. And I've kind of, for a long time, felt, well, if I lose my life, that's what happens. And maybe what can you lose by trusting? Oh, depends. It's always been with me some sense of trust and wanting to trust. Maybe it's a vulnerability, maybe it's a foolishness. Wanting to trust, wanting a world that you would love to live in or you would love your children to live in, wanting it, and you've got to want it and act as if. It's a kind of a strange, it's the old notion of the fool. I'm a fool. And that is the ancient, the village fool, the court jester, that's been my function, to express what is repressed, to say out loud what people are, is semi-conscious in people. I love the semi-conscious more than the unconscious or the conscious. I think semi-consciousness is my state. I speak out of semi-consciousness a lot. But so it's always there, always wanting. It's a fool, the holy fool, I dare say, in mythology. So, you know, the trusting child, I see the value of it. I see the value of it, and I'm privileged to be able to hang on to a bit of it. I mean, of course, there's a lot of things I'm wary of. It was the last one. It was the gentleman down there who had also had a...
Well, mine was just a request that you read us a poem or two.
Sorry?
Read us a poem or two.
I don't know what one, but I just want to say. Well, I just want to say this. Look, while I say all of this, obviously, the thing I admire so much is skillfulness, and I adore to see skillfulness and that people make themselves skillful and can. I love to watch a tradesman work on a. Building something or whatever. And if you want to talk about love, let me tell you this tiny story to finish. And I wouldn't know what poem to say, nothing comes to mind. I'll tell you about love. Only this. One day I was in the city of Melbourne. It was a busy day. There were big trucks roaring about everywhere, traffic, cranes in the sky, great prosperity, crashing and banging of industry and prosperity. And I'm walking along the street and I notice a man, and he's a worker, and he's down on his knees. He's a concrete worker and he's fixing a bit of broken curb, and he's down there on his knees and he's so intent and so focused on, with his little trowel on the wet cement, making it just beautiful, you see, in the midst of all this. And I thought, now that's love. That is love, that you make your work, no matter how humble, you enjoy. He was enjoying it and he was giving it all the loving attention. And I think love has got so much to do with attention, enjoyable attention. And that's my little story about love. Perhaps that's a point at which I can stop.